If there were a prize for genocide, one man would have unbeatable odds of claiming it. He began life as a bright young revolutionary with enormous enthusiasm for change and fairness. But he devolved into a fat, dirty old tyrant who filled everyone with fear and loathing. He was at China's helm when up to 55 million people died in just four devastating years. His name was Chairman Mao, and he changed China forever. Blind History, Season 7. And I think it's fair to say this guy's a villain, right?
Yeah, I would say, I think in the last couple of centuries, he's got to be the leader that had made the biggest change in China. So you have to look at both sides.
You could even argue that he made the biggest change in terms of pulling the most people out of poverty.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to give some of that credit to the successor, Deng Xiaoping. But this guy, I mean, Mao Zedong, right?
Yeah. Like,
what a monster of a human being. Monster in a good and bad way.
100%.
So I don't really like the dude, but who cares what I think? We'll give you the opportunity to decide that as we tell you the story. Anthony Miedere, Gareth Cliff, Blind History. Let's get into Mao Zedong, or Mao Zedong, depending on how you pronounce it. It doesn't really matter. It's like phonetic. And if you don't speak Chinese, if you don't speak Mandarin, it's not going to make a difference to you. So this guy, I suppose the best way to, I'll just read you the top line and then we can fill in from there on. Chinese Communist Revolutionary, founder of the People's Republic of China, chairman of the Chinese Communist Party from its establishment until his death. Ideologically, you could call him a Marxist-Leninist, but they started calling his form of communism Maoism. And he was in charge of 1/5 of the world's population at one point. And without a doubt, China will never be the same, and could never have been the country that it is now without this guy at the helm. But having said that, the millions of dead bodies that are piled up in order to bring about the kind of social engineering and change that he wanted to initiate in China, that death toll, that cost, is for some immeasurably high. And I think without taking due cognizance of the total number of lives that he not only ruined or ended, but all those people who were associated with those people who we've just mentioned. I mean, this guy, he did a tremendous amount of harm in pursuit of his goals. There's no other way to say it.
So if he saved by improving medical facilities for rural areas and bringing China out of the dark ages, let's say education, he took two lives for every one he improved. So it's, and if we think about it, I don't think there's anybody on this planet that can be responsible, let me say inverted commas, for north of 70 million deaths of his own people, it has to be said.
Yeah, this is not a warmonger who went to war with another nation and cost them lives.
Yeah.
This is someone who, from the moment of, you know, the Chinese Civil War beginning with the Kuomintang right through to his last dying breath in 1976, took out that many of his own people. Let's not even count the outsiders who he may or may not have even paid attention to. You know, there was the Sino-Japanese Wars, two of them. There was obviously World War II. And then there were plenty of other things that happened in between. But clearly, in the pursuit of these higher goals and these ideological imperatives, lives didn't really make a difference.
No, he had total disdain for life. I think in the beginning, and we can unpack his, you know, his journey from when he was very young, but in the beginning, I think ideologically there was, yes, it made a lot of sense to him and what he believed in. You mentioned Marxism, you mentioned communism, and later on became Maoism. I mean, he was more of a cult. He was more of
semi-divine. It became worship of a person.
Yeah, and then I think that's where it got blurred because similar to Stalin, and for that matter, for even the fascists at the time, they actually lost they lost the feeling of what the hell was going on. They just went.
Have you heard the story of the mango?
I did hear the story of the mangoes from Pakistan.
So a Pakistani delegation sent 40 mangoes to him as a gift. So he obviously couldn't eat 40 mangoes, so he shared them out among some people. And one of these mangoes ended up in a factory. And these guys tasted this mango, and they were blown away. No one in China had ever tasted a mango before. They couldn't believe something would taste so nice. They believed it was magic. And they believed that Mao had invested this fruit with magic. And they put it in a glass jar. And as it started to rot, they put a wax version in there. And anybody who even said that it wasn't magical and that Mao hadn't blessed it with some divine provenance would have been killed. Yeah. I mean, if that isn't a personality cult, and this is in the 20th century, we're not talking about barbarians in like 300 AD.
No, 100%. You know, yeah.
We're talking about modern, educated people who were so in love with the idea of worshipping this man, or where they'd been propagandized to the extent that they believed this man was divine, where they would give a fruit this kind of power. You know, that's just, it's a type
that's
of insanity.
Exactly, the mango debacle.
It's insanity. So where did he start off? He was the son of a reasonably prosperous, if you can put that in inverted commas, peasant in central China. His dad he bought up like 2 acres of land, and he was able to farm it fairly effectively. He hired some other people to work the land for him. He was a capitalist for all intents and purposes. And Mao, I think, was inspired by this, but he wanted more. Yeah. And he wanted to be an intellectual. He didn't want to work on the farm. So he was clearly clever. I mean, a lot of these people who end up becoming really malignant, tyrannical dictators later on in life are very clever. Mm. He went to elementary school, did very well, top of his class and all that stuff. And then they pulled him out of school, tried to arrange a marriage for him, which he was not.
They're the first parts of rebellion, because you do not rebel against your parents in 1900s China.
Yeah.
And he rebelled, and he just left this arranged marriage, and he hated that for the rest of his life. He left her high and dry, and he just disappeared.
Yeah. And then he went to school. Proper school after that, and he did pretty well. And he started reading. He was a voracious reader. He would read anything you put in front of him: menus, roadmaps, anything.
And became a competent poet.
Oh yeah,
I read some of his poetry, and
I mean, later on, his Little Red Book would be considered the greatest literary work in Chinese history. Obviously, this nonsense, but one of the one of the Chinese intellectuals at the time said that Mao's one sentence was worth 10,000 of our sentences.
Yes, but then let's just clarify that intellectual, because all the intellectual have been killed. So I don't know how intellectual that intellectual
was. It was a shallow pool.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But those red books, I've got one at home. These were, if you didn't have it on you, you'd probably find yourself in a shallow grave. Mm. I mean, you had to have it on you the whole time.
Yeah. But some of the photographs, but that's later on, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But some
we were
of them
jumping
were,
ahead.
But they were insane. But then he went to go study, 100% right. And then when he was there, though, and if we had to look at the whole world at the time, 1911, 1917, I think it was a bad time to be a king, queen, or prince on this planet, because you were seeing that everybody's being executed. I mean, if you look at the dynasty, the Romanovs, the French Revolution was quite a lot before, but there was a whole lot of, especially in Russia, which was on their doorstep, there was peasant uprising, there was that whole change that took place, and that happened in China as well.
Yeah.
And effectively, he was at the forefront there.
Well, the Qin dynasty, which had ruled China for years, hundreds of years, was eventually displaced. The last emperor was a two-year-old called Puyi, and clearly, imperial governments had fallen out of favor. Mm. And China was in the throes of revolution, which most of the world was at that point. And Mao was very much at that point he was an enthusiastic supporter of revolution.
Yeah.
And he believed communism was the best way to manifest that revolution for the benefit of the average Chinese person.
And I think at this stage, I don't know what was going on in his head, but he hadn't snapped yet. So
no.
You
could say that.
Yeah. So he wasn't professing violence yet. It was almost. I mean, it was very ideologically driven towards. Even in the beginning, there were some people that he supported that some part of capitalism slash democracy. There were a lot of thought leaders.
He was reasonable.
I think that's a good point. Yeah,
he was also young.
Yeah,
but there was a civil war at that point in China because essentially the government after the overthrowing of the emperor, the government had become a nationalist government, and the Kuomintang under the leadership of Chiang Kai-shek had become the dominant force in China. And this guy did not like communists.
But just has to be said that Chiang Kai-shek was as unhinged.
Oh yeah.
As Mao.
Yeah.
He was a complete nut job.
So by the way, if you want to know where Taiwan comes from, we're at the beginning stages of China and Taiwan and what would happen eventually. But the Taiwanese flag is still the Kuomintang flag. Mm. And the Chinese Communist Party flag is still as established by Mao.
Yeah.
But essentially, these two did not see eye to eye. Chiang Kai-shek, as you say, was unhinged and effectively murdered hundreds of thousands of communists.
Mm. He turned against Mao and the gang.
And these guys had to run and hide. And they basically fled into rural China and began what they called a long march. Mm. These Chinese communists who'd been sidelined and in most cases been redlined, they were going to be murdered if they were caught, started a long march through rural China, the mountains, through farms, past every peasant village. And Mao took the opportunity on this march to explain how communism was going to improve their lives, how he would make everything better. And he did essentially a foot soldiers campaign of propaganda, reminding people that what was going on with these warlords who the Kuomintang had put in place was not the best way for this thing to operate.
And effectively also, they had a few battles on the way. I mean, there was a lot of propaganda around the Long March. I think it, especially later on, it was the founding of this.
Oh, yeah, look, they added a lot of bullshit.
Yeah, 100%.
but some of it was a very impressive history of the foundation of this party that eventually would rule.
Could it have been 1,000 miles? I can't remember the exact figure, but it was a very, very long way that they walked. But also at this stage, they took a lot of where they settled, in the areas that they settled, they took the farms away from the peasants and gave them to some of the Red Army at the stage.
Right, and then later they would establish these communes.
Correct, yeah.
But essentially ownership of land, which clearly communists don't believe in, was starting to become something that they were against. Anyway, Chiang Kai-shek at this point realized also that he was in some trouble because the Japanese had launched the Manchurian War. They tried to place a puppet emperor or a puppet ruler on the throne. And he needed help because he was running out of steam and the Japanese were winning. So he decided to swallow his pride and make some kind of collaboration, an alliance with Mao. So he took the Communist Party into his confidence, decided that they shouldn't be outlawed anymore, wasn't going to kill any more of them. So they allied these two. And the communists still had lots of energy and vim and vigor, but the nationalists had run out of steam by that point. But together, they did manage to fight back and they did manage to push. And it has to be said, the Japanese launched a very brutal campaign against the Chinese at
that
point.
They wanted that whole northern province to themselves.
But the things that happened, I mean, the amount of, murder and rape and just destruction that took place there is something which really is a blight on the Japanese reputation, even to this day.
Yeah.
Many Chinese have still not forgiven them.
But Stalin also popped in for a bit of a help. You know,
he was.
Because Mao really, really, really looked up to Stalin. And at that time, they had a good relationship. Interestingly enough, when he went to visit him in Moscow, he sort of treated him like a normal human being rather than this esteemed head of this 500 million people. Apologies. And so that really upset him. And he wanted to get his own back, but he got his own back on the next
Khrushchev.
And he made him sit in a very hot room with no air conditioning, and then the next meeting he had was in a swimming pool, and Khrushchev couldn't swim, so he was trying to get his own back.
Well, we'll get to how Mao didn't swim either. He also didn't wash, but we'll talk about that in a second. Just to get the history under the belt, at this point though, it is fairly clear that the Communist Party was in the ascendant, and that the nationalists were in decline, Chiang Kai-shek eventually had to give up and flee to Taiwan and established that government and that independent republic there. So it's, since then, it's always been Taiwan and mainland China. And to this day, and probably not for very long, they remain separate. But it was always a bit of a thorn in the side of the communists that the nationalists had gone off to Formosa and established Taiwan. To this day, they also maintain a very separate identity and a much more capitalist outlook on the world. I mean, China, it has to be said, is really communist in name only.
Yeah.
Because what's really pulled them out of rural and impoverished agricultural peasant population dynamics into a modern economy has been capitalism and, you know, places like Shanghai, manufacture, being able to sell things on the open market internationally, shipping, logistics, that kind of thing. But I mean, this guy had some crazy ideas.
But this started with, but Mao started actually with what you're saying in terms of that. He wanted to create his big vision was to make China a superpower. And clearly in 1900, it was definitely not a superpower. In 1970, it was a superpower. So effectively, he did what he set out to achieve, but ultimately at massive, massive cost.
Well, the Great Leap Forward is kind of where he started. He had this idea that the Great Leap Forward, that they could, through social and economic campaigns, launch a reconstruction of the country and turn it from an agrarian economy into a massive industrial economy. And they did crazy things. Like, for example, everyone in the country was put to work in factories where all they had as a background was kind of growing plants and food. Mm. They were melting down bicycles and, you know, steel that they built their houses out of and all kinds of other things.
Yeah, so lots of
low quality, crappy steel, just so that everybody was busy doing that.
Maybe that's where
project.
It came made in China from. Maybe in the old days where you just looked at something and fell apart.
Well, the Great Leap Forward, you have to say, was more or less a failure. But there were all sorts of other weird things that he was doing. Like, for example, they had the Four Pests program, where they basically shot out, and you're a bit of a conservationist, they shot out the entire bird population of China.
All the sparrows.
Tigers, leopards. So many of the indigenous animals that lived in China were just exterminated to the point where many of them have gone completely extinct and do not exist anymore. Because he believed they were pests that were stealing, you know, food crops. There was also a huge famine in the late 1950s, early 1960s.
But I think, Gareth, just to talk, because the Great Leap Forward was really a great leap into just a burning pot of fire, because the strict targets were set, you know, and targets set, inverted commas, because if you didn't reach the targets, could end up being quite sore, like you said, a shallow grave or some other compound. But
some people were beaten.
But the thing, though, is that they used to be farming their crops, and that used to provide maize, etc., for the country. So they were no longer doing that. They were now trying to melt down their bicycles, as you said. So ultimately, there's no food. So it's man-made famine, like our friend Stalin, and he didn't give a fucking shit. This oak.
No, but this is always the case with communists. They have a goal that's an ideological goal, and in theory it looks great, but in practice it never works. They don't take into consideration human nature. And when people are desperate and they're hungry, I mean, there's horrible stories about what happened, people eating their pets, people resorting to cannibalism, which we know from North Korea and we know from the Soviet Union seems to be a result of implementing these policies.
Exactly. And 38 million people. I mean, it was one of the biggest famine catastrophes on this planet. Yeah. And then in the end, he realized, oops, hang on, I can't sell any of the steel you've made. Because you can shoot sheep, you can shoot peas through it. So it's so if that was a catastrophe out of the top drawer.
What I think you could say was a success is his cultural revolution, because this is much easier to do. This is like persuading young people that you are a god king, that you exist on earth as some sort of divine spirit, that they must exterminate all of your enemies. And he started this with the students who, you know, their heads are soft, which is why so many good and bad ideas come out of universities. But essentially, it was a socio-political movement in China. It started around 1966 and lasted all the way till his death. And the goal, obviously, was to preserve Chinese communism. But what they did was they destroyed everything that old China had, old Chinese culture, old Chinese habits, old Chinese traditions, was all destroyed.
Old Chinese people.
And the Great Wall was torn apart so that they could build dams out of those stones from the Great Wall. I mean, there's so much of Chinese history that has been thrown into the fire that we will never be able to learn, we'll never be able to recover. And you and I are history fans. That's why we do this podcast. The richness of Chinese history was almost completely obliterated by this man's desire to socially engineer a new China.
And he kept jeering them on. He never ever said, no, stop this. And in the end, the group of youths started turning on themselves because there's nobody else to kill.
Right. I mean, you eventually run out of victims.
Yeah.
And you start victimizing each other. But they used to do ridiculous things. Like they'd find intellectuals, they'd pour ink on their heads, they'd shout at them, they'd do what they called struggle sessions, where they essentially tie these people up and beat them until they admitted how they were wrong, even though they weren't wrong. It was like under duress.
And foreigners, there's a story of a British foreigner that brought his family because he's disillusioned by communism at the time. This is at the culture, just before the Cultural Revolution. So he went to China because this is where he felt Mao was the man and taking it forward. And when the 3 or 4 years later, they locked them up in a hotel for 2 years, one little hotel room for 2 years, the family, the mother and the father and the son. And I don't know how they managed to escape. They dodged a big bullet and they ended up back home. But just all of these things. So all the foreigners were deported. Anybody else that was against it were murdered. And you couldn't control this mob effectively. He didn't want to.
No, it suited him. At that stage also, he had failed in the Great Leap Forward. He'd been for a while exiled to the provinces and some other people took over. His two lieutenants, who eventually were also displaced when he came back into power. But now we're talking about a guy in his 70s. So he's a little bit addled. He never used to wash. He believed like he would wash himself with his women. And he had a group of women that he would travel around the country with, some of them quite young and pretty. And he would give them STDs because he was a filthy, filthy old man. He had a 16-year-old secretary at one point who was so powerful that she controlled his wife's access to him. And he...
That was for 10 years, one of his concubines. That's exactly...
He didn't believe he needed to brush his teeth.
Yeah. So what happened was that the story went with the teeth, which is really, really flippant, freakish, is that he would only use tea leaves. He would rub his teeth with tea leaves. And then he started to get pus in his gums.
Oh, God.
And then the physician warned him, look, let's you need to really wash your teeth. This is really getting bad. And he said, does a tiger brush his teeth? That was his answer. So he never ever brushed his teeth. He never bathed. He just swam.
In the Yangtze River. But to prove that he still had.
But that was when he came back. So what happened was he came back now. He was in exile a little bit, like you said. And then I can't pronounce the guy that took over from him, finally, took over from his wife.
Right.
He was sort of running it at the time. And he came back and he jumped in the river and he swam. I think it was 8 times faster than the world record.
In the
river.
Yeah, well, we know that's nonsense. I mean, he was already a man in his 70s.
But. Yeah, I mean, the thing with him was that he never walked the walk. He had 50 estates that he would, because he was always on the run, he was very worried about that.
Right.
But he had 50 estates all around China. He had his concubines, so he didn't practice what he preached.
Nope.
And then he was the only author or publisher in China. Nobody else was allowed to publish any books. So he was making millions from his red book. And even his estate today is still making millions from his red book. So,
yeah. He also fell out of favor with the Soviet Union. They eventually closed down all diplomatic relations between the two. He did have a huge influence on the establishment of North Korea. And in the Korean War, obviously, China threw their weight behind the communists in the North. And obviously, in the South, in Vietnam, he backed Ho Chi Minh and helped to establish that whole regime. But the guy was already starting to become a bit crabby and old. I mean, famously, who was it? It was Kissinger who went to visit him. And he said to Kissinger, don't you want 40 million of our women? I'll send them to you in America. You can have 40 million of our women. These women are a problem. Mm. They just cause trouble.
Yeah, this exactly.
Kissinger didn't know how to respond to this. Are you going to take 40 million Chinese women into America? He's like, no, thank you. But famously also Nixon, had started to make rapprochement with China so that they could. I mean, that was quite an insightful move on Nixon's part, because he realized like China could be a major manufacturing economy and they needed to be a partner rather than an enemy. But really, by the end of his life, he didn't have a whole lot of friends, but people were still terrified of him because one bad thing that he could say about you could still end your life, you know, right up to the end. People were terrified, and he did not brook any kind of discussion around succession. Who would take over? He wasn't interested.
Yeah, he was. He thought he'd live forever. And his physician kept warning him, the same poor physician with bad his teeth.
Surprised he survived.
And you know, that he said, look, you need to stop smoking. He was a chain smoker. He said, look, I mean, smoking is good for me. I deep breathe when I do it. I breathe deeply when I do it. And then all the other thing is that this is a really, really frightening thing. And you never know if it's 100% true. But his wife had to have the disgusting task of getting the fingers to empty his bowels manually because he had such a bad constipation. And luckily, she found the process of enema to help him. So, I mean, anyway, I mean, this is quite scary.
Well, he eventually had two major heart attacks. And then they announced his death. Everyone went quiet. It was, oh, God, what's going to happen now? They preserved his body in formaldehyde and put him in a glass casket where people could walk past forever. You think that the Queen of England was lying in state for a long time. Well, this guy's been lying in state ever since he died. And people still file past.
So that's 50 years, Odd.
Yeah, it's a long time.
Nearly 50 years.
And his mausoleum is still there.
In Tiananmen Square.
Yep. Which is ironically the place where later on Deng Xiaoping and now Xi, Chairman Xi, would launch, you know, their big May Day celebrations, show off the Chinese military, make sure that the rest of the world could take them seriously because they were a mighty nation. But also where famously the Tiananmen massacre happened, where, you know, a student and many others were just rolled over by tanks. And it continues to be a country where you're not really encouraged to have individual thought. You must toe the line. It doesn't matter what you think of Chinese history. The only thing that matters is what happened since Mao came in. There was no history before the communists.
And I think, you know, there's just murmurs of going back to its roots now a little bit with the present regime. And it's making a few people nervous, especially, you know, because it is a massive, you mentioned it, it's a powerhouse. I mean, so many of us are reliant on importing raw material from China.
He would have been furious, Mao, if he'd seen what Deng would do later on. Because Deng basically opened the gates to capitalism and said, okay, let's start participating in the world. And Mao would have been furious. His biggest fear was that China would go back to being capitalist. Of course, that capitalism saved and rescued millions, if not billions of people from poverty. The greatest improvement in living standards for that number of people in human history. So in some ways, he maybe laid the groundwork for what would eventually be the salvation of so many people.
Yeah, I think it was very similar to Hitler. You know, if Hitler would have walked away in 1939 or 38, people might have said, you know, he
a hero.
Yeah, and the same applies to him if he would have walked away in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't.
No.
And there's just, I mean, it's hectic reading this stuff, Gareth. It's really just living in, you know, we talk often about the times we live in. But if you can just imagine, you know, you're born into this this country and you're subject to, it doesn't matter who you were. It could have been the peasants. Then it was the peasants against the intellects or the middle class.
Well, bourgeoisie. I mean, eventually it was the bourgeoisie because he had to find a new enemy.
Exactly.
And then once they were exterminated, then it was about like, his own red army turning on each other.
So you were permanently sort of unstable and on the run living in the.
It must have been horrible.
Yeah.
Must have been horrible. And they still got portraits of him all over.
And his wife, so he was married three times.
Mm-hmm.
But the wife that was with him when he finally passed away, she had been an actress.
Yeah.
But she would.
Quite an attractive woman.
Yes. But she would incite violence. She was his puppet. He hated her, you know, at the end. But,
oh, well, she also had a whole bunch of lovers, just like he did.
Yes, and in the end, she took control of China when he died, together with the Big Four, I think it's called something like that. But Deng Ping basically put her in jail, and then that was the end of that. And then she committed suicide.
Her name was Zhang Qing.
Correct, yeah. Or they called her Madam Mao.
Sure. Well, here he is. I mean, if you really like the guy, then you need to have your head read. But many Chinese people still regard him as the greatest human being who ever lived. And you know what? Ours not to reason why. All we have in this podcast is the opportunity to tell you the story. I mean, he's, you know, if you want to take the propaganda view, greatest literary publisher in Chinese history, the man who founded modern China.
Olympic swimmer.
Clean, lovely human being. Yes. Everyone loved and wanted to be around. But you can probably read between the lines. Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History. Every episode is available on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. In the next episode... I think he was taken out of Africa at the age of 8 as a slave. And because he was a slave of noble origin, he was a particularly prized possession. And he was sent to the court of the Ottoman emperor. I think it was Mustafa, the then Ottoman sultan.